Welcome to Heard at Heritage. Heard at Heritage features cutting-edge analysis and thought from leading experts in and across the conservative movement, as well as premier events and programming from the Heritage Foundation here in the heart of Washington, D.C., brought straight to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our program, Next Gen Marxism, what it is and how to combat it. Please welcome Heritage President, Dr. Kevin Roberts.
Thank you for being here, and welcome, a particular welcome to C-SPAN and to all of our friends who've joined online. This is an exceedingly important topic of discussion in a nation that is beset with a lot of exceedingly important topics for discussion. Because you see, if we get this topic right, and we are eventually going to get this topic of combating Marxism right, then we're going to succeed in taking back this wonderful republic. And so it's a great privilege for me not only to make some introductions of our speakers today, but to work with them. I get to work with Mike Gonzalez full-time, I get to work with Katie Gorka part-time, and I often am graced with the presence of my friend Sebastian Gorka, who does such a great job being an American patriot. The importance of this book cannot be overstated. And the reason I say that isn't really just because I'm president of the Heritage Foundation, it's because I once was the lone Christian conservative faculty member in the entire faculty of the College of Arts and Sciences at a major public research university in the Southwest, the only one, which says something about recruitment. And this is a long time ago, as you can tell from the lack of hair on my head. Now, I'm a cheerful guy, a forgiving fellow, and so I tolerated them, but they didn't tolerate me. And they didn't tolerate me because they hated what I stand for. And what I stand for is what the vast, vast majority of common sense Americans practice every day, which is going to work, raising a family, some of them starting businesses, some of them very happily working at other businesses, some of them working in nonprofits and governments. In other words, what Marxists have attempted to do over the last century isn't just initiate wars, but corrode and deteriorate the health of our institutions. Every single institution of any consequence in this country. And it takes heroism, tremendous courage to fight back against this. What I love about this book and what I love about the personal witness of each of these panelists today and their respective work is their willingness to call out the nonsense of the Marxist ideology, but very importantly and appropriately in Heritage fashion, to articulate the playbook for taking back every one of those institutions. So for any Marxist watching this, you ought to be scared. It's a privilege to welcome to the stage Mike Gonzalez, Katie Gorka, and Sebastian Gorka. Please join me in welcoming them here.
If I could be at the end.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. And especially, I think, with the people in the room and people online, we're pushing like 1,000 people watching right now. So congratulations, Mike and Katie. I'm going to get my note card out. It's a very good one. It's nice to have my wife back after a year of, what did you call Mike? Your second husband, right? So nice to have you back, Katie. Congratulations on the publication of a book that could not be more timely. A lot was learned by both of you and by me during the process. Let's start with those momentous days, 1989. Those of us who are old enough remember it well. November 9th, the fall of the Berlin Wall, just a year and a half after Reagan said, tear it down. That's when, you know, speeches matter. Literally a year and a half afterwards, the people of the captive nation of East Germany with their hands, with pickaxes, took down the Berlin Wall. However, at the same time, Mike found an article had been published by Felicity Beringer, which is a very different take on the events of 1989. You introduced that article to me, Katie. Would you say what was shocking about Berenger's article and why it really is the preface to this new book?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one of the reasons that we wanted to write the book was we wanted to understand how we've gotten to where we are today. And I thought, you know, Mike found a really key clue, which was this article from 1989, written, I think, published several months before the fall of the Berlin Wall, where Felicity Berenger wrote in the New York Times that Marxism had gone mainstream in U.S. colleges. Marxism had gone mainstream and been accepted.
And she's writing that in 1989.
And what's so interesting about that is that anybody who wasn't a Marxist, but who understood the threat of Marxism, we were all looking elsewhere, right? We were all looking either at China and Tiananmen Square, you were actually in Hong Kong, or we were looking at Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. We thought we had won. And here was this whole drama going on in the United States that honestly nobody had their eyes on. And I'll just mention two other key things that happened in that same year that we kind of missed. One was that was the year that critical race theory came into being. That was the year of the conference where critical race theory was named and the group came together. And then the other thing is it also happens to be the year that Eric Mann, right, former SDS member, former Weather Underground, formed his organizing organization in Los Angeles. So you have all these pieces that come together, and these are very foundational to how we've gotten to where we are today.
For those who aren't familiar with Eric Mann, you wrote the seminal work on Black Lives Matter, Mike. So can you take us from 89 to today and explain why this is next-gen Marxism and who Mann is and why, for example, BLM and Antifa fit into this story?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And thank you all for being here, by the way. Katie and I are very, very happy that you were competing against museums, against many other great places here in Washington. So thank you very much for being here. One of the things I found about the Berenger article is that she herself says, this is a former Moscow reporter for the New York Times, no less. She says, you know, what's odd is that Marxism is failing in Eastern Europe, but it's succeeding on U.S. campuses. So she draws the contrast, and she does something else that is very interesting. She said, but you would imagine Marxism to be resurgent in the economic departments, but it's not. It's not economics. They are resurgent in the humanities and the law faculties. So she has a reporter's eye and is seeing a trend that, as Katie says, very, very important to the future. Eric Mann, I was having lunch. I don't want to drop names as a typical Washington pastime, but I was having lunch with a thought leader in the Democratic Party, a guy who's been a leftist all his life, but he's a great guy. He's beginning to have doubts, so I don't want to mention his name. But he said to me, why do more people not talk about Eric Mann? Why does he only preoccupy you and me? Because Eric Mann is actually a key figure, right? Not only is he a former terrorist, and I guess, I always find it weird to say former terrorist, because I think you're a terrorist.
You know? Like a Marine, you're always a Marine, right?
Unfortunately, I'm a journalist, even though I haven't been a journalist in 20 years. But he then, as Katie said, he establishes his labor community strategy center in LA, which is really a Marxist preparatory. And by the way, in about a decade after that, he recruits Patrice Cullors. And this is the word he uses. He writes a book in 2011. And by the way, this is all open source. The New York Times doesn't bother to look into these things, but you can. His book published in 2011 says he recruits this brilliant organizer by the name of Patrice Cullors at the tender age of 17. So he recruits her, that would make it about 98. And he writes it in 2011. Nothing has happened to Trayvon Martin yet. You know, he hasn't met with George Zimmerman. This is the catalyzing event for Black Lives Matter.
But she is the co-founder.
Patrice Cullors, in case you don't know, is one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. He is also one of the organizers of the U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta in 2007. what is the U.S. Social Forum? Well, there was a world social forum that was begun by Marxists, by Parisian and Brazilian Marxists, about 7 years earlier in the year 2000, and then Hugo Chavez, you know, says in 2006 at a meeting in Atlanta, in Venezuela, in Caracas, we need to establish a U.S. beachhead. And I really have to give credit to Ariel Sheen, who's sitting right there, a very keen researcher in Florida who's done a lot of great work on this, and I do in my book as well. And Chavez says, compañeros, American compañeros, we need to establish a beachhead in the belly of the beast. And lo and behold, in 2007, Eric Mann is one of on the organizing committee of the U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta, who's also there, Seb. Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza are also
the founders of Black Lives
Matter. In 2007, years before Trayvon Martin ever came across George Zimmerman in that fateful day.
Without two individuals, there is no Eric Mann, there is no AOC, there is no BLM, and those two individuals that we must discuss for a moment are Antonio Gramsci, and then here in America, Saul Alinsky. Katie, you can talk to us about Saul because you've examined him closely. Why is Gramsci the person who changes modern Marxism that we are where we are today? Explain his significance, Mike.
So let me do this in 30 seconds, if I can, the run up to this. Somebody wrote, and I agree with it entirely, that up to that, before the Russian Revolution, Marxism was going through this Marxian stage. From 2017 to 24 is the Leninist stage. After that is the Stalinist stage. Stalin dies in 53. It's the Maoist stage. Mao dies in 76, right? After that is the Gramscian age of communism. And I truly believe that we're in the Gramscian age. And all the luminaries, all the architects of critical race theory, not all of them, but the key ones, cite Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci is influential in the work of Judith Butler, who does the sex part of this, the gender part of this. Antonio Gramsci is the one, he's the man who founds Italy's Communist Party in 1921, and he is one of the first one, not the only one, but one of the key people, one of the key cultural Marxists, Western Marxists, who asks himself the question, why did the Italian Revolution fail? I could not establish an Italian Soviet. Why did the German Revolution fail? They could not establish a German Soviet. The reason is that the worker has bought into the cultural matrix of the ruling class. The Marx had said that the nation state, the family, private property, and God needed to be abolished. He said most of those things in the manifesto. He's of 1848. He says others before or after the manifesto, and the worker loved his family, worshiped God, was patriotic, and loved what little private property he had. He did not want to let go of it. Didn't want the state to take it away. And why is that? Because Marx had never met a worker. He was the original limousine Marxist. He was working away in the library in London, doing research the whole time. He didn't know what a worker wanted. So Gramsci is the first one. I know I'm going too long, but Gramsci is the first one to think the worker has false consciousness. We need to through struggle sessions. And by the way, because Sebastian always reminds me, bring it to the present. The struggle sessions are happening today. These are your anti-racist sessions that are happening. But
his big contribution was to say it's the culture stupid.
It's the culture stupid.
Right.
The worker has bought into the cultural matrix of the rich and powerful, set up by the rich and powerful to remain rich and powerful. We need to disabuse the worker of this attachment to the culture. We need to dump all over the culture, get rid of it, and replace it with a counterculture.
So he's the first truly successful cultural Marxist. He says, take over from the inside, that which you cannot destroy with the revolution.
Yeah.
But Katie, explain for us Saul Alinsky, the transition. Why is it, for example, that Hillary Clinton writes her thesis on Saul Alinsky? Why is it the only, and please fact check me, the only photograph you can find of the great constitutional scholar Barack Obama giving a lecture as a professor is him diagramming out Saul Alinsky on a chalkboard. This is the only photograph you can find of him teaching.
Two Chicago friends.
Right, right. So why is Alinsky so seminal to the next gen Marxism birth?
Right. So there was a very complicated relationship with the revolutionaries, the communists in the United States, right? Communism sort of took hold for a while. There was a time when people really thought, oh, maybe communism really is a kinder, better way of going forward. And, you know, we laugh now, but, at the time, it was quite prevalent, right? But little by little, people woke up to it. There was no workers' revolution, as Mike said. Workers wanted their jobs. They didn't want to overthrow. So what happens, though? Saul Alinsky learns from the communist organizers. He learns from the Communist Party. And he takes that concept of both organizing, but also creating a sense of victimhood and a sense of grievance to start mobilizing people. And now he started in sort of the slums of Chicago. Eventually he moves on to Los Angeles. Right. But he basically gave us the form of community organizing, yes, on which the left has built its, yes, current position. And, you know, it's not only Eric Mann's center, but also if you look at Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s, very, very important to all of this, because what they eventually learned was that their revolution also failed, right? They didn't bring about the revolution they wanted. So many people just kind of went on and lived their lives, but there were two groups of leadership from that chose another path. So one group went terrorism. They said, we're not being radical enough. Right. They formed the Weather Underground. They tried terrorism. But another group said, no, we just need to organize better. And so they formed the Midwestern Academy. And they have been training people. They are still training people today. They've been training people for decades. And that's a big part of how they've gotten to where they are today.
This is so true. And in fact, before he died, Alinsky told Playboy, everybody worked with the Reds. You're nodding your head. You read that too. It's like if anybody
who bought it for the articles.
look, I quote Alinsky where Alinsky is. Don't shake your head. He said, anybody doing the kind of work that I was doing who tells you didn't work with the Reds is lying to you. I worked with the Reds. You had to work with the Reds. Mm-hmm.
The relevance of next-gen Marxism is not just to paint the history and the evolution, but especially the last chapter of the so what, how do we fix it and fight it here in America. But I want to open the aperture slightly and not just focus on America, because in the last year, I've learned a great deal from you, Mike, and also Joseph Humire from the Center for a Free, Secure Society, on how this isn't a uniquely American problem. It's not just AOC and the racist president of Harvard and the transgender lunatics. This is an international phenomenon. So could you talk about the fascinating global web, especially in Latin America and in Spanish-speaking, and Europe broadly, of these people who are actually organizing in a new socialist international?
In fact, I have it on good authority that Lula, who's the increasingly dictatorial president of Brazil, is in constant contact, or not constant, but in often enough contact with Bernie Sanders, AOC. Look, what Katie mentioned and talked about Saul Alinsky, when we were, figuring out this book, we said, well, what differentiates the cultural Marxists, of like Gramsci, the people in the mid-century, with next-gen Marxists? And that is the addition of American pathogens, such as organizing, a la Alinsky, such as the use of queer theory, the use of the obsession with race, which you find roots of in cultural Marxism, but it definitely goes on, steroids in the American context. Another one is, as Seb brings up, is the use of global, of networks that span the globe, massive Marxist networks that span the globe. And it is there, and they help each other. In the fateful year of 2020, and in the reason why America has, Katie and I wrote this book because, our world is changing, and I use the expression cultural genocide, and that's not an exaggeration. We're facing an attempt to really change our culture, the American way of life, to which all three of us here, and many of you in the audience, if not all, really love. And that's what we're faced with. And one way they want to achieve this is by meeting internationally. But in 2020, Black Lives Matter sent out, I think 124, this is the BLM-GNF, the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, which used to be the main BLM group. They sent out something like 120 million emails and to organize the protests and the over 600 riots. And the people distributing these things, and not just that year of 2020, but in the run-up to it, was a vast network, was distributing it online. And it was not just Americans, but it was international leftists. And just two points that I want to bring up here. In that U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta in 2007, there was a big contingent of Palestinians, 2007. And in Ferguson, just a few months after the Black Lives Matter is formed, it really gels in Ferguson and becomes a global phenomenon, a national phenomenon in Ferguson. There were also a big contingent of Palestinians marching. And that ends in December of 2014. In 2015, in January or February, Patrice Couleurs finds herself in the West Bank with Palestinians cutting videos. The videos are online, look them up. The New York Times doesn't bother to do that, but you can. And she is there protesting the Israeli colonists, the Israeli settler state.
And all the oppression of blacks in Gaza. Right?
All the oppression taking place in Gaza and the West Bank. So yes, this international component is impossible to disassociate. It's not an American phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's the BLM. Global Network Foundation.
Yeah, fascinating.
And I just want to add, yeah, because I think this is super important. You know, I hear so often on the right, we beat ourselves up, and this is, you know, amongst the conservatives, we beat ourselves up and we say, compared to the left, we're so disorganized. But look at what they have, and look at what we are up against. Our biggest enemies are involved in these organizations. Venezuela, China, Iran. I mean, there are countless of our enemies are helping to fuel this movement against us. I mean, do not be fooled. These are not just your Democratic housewives in the suburbs who are making this stuff happen. So I just say, on the right, let's not beat ourselves up so much. But at the same time, let's understand exactly what they're doing. Let's understand the way they are using organizing. And let's better organize and confront that.
Well, that can't be done without getting the book, which is available outside, signed by the authors. I want to be cognizant of the time. I will take questions from the floor, but two more questions for you here as authors. On my radio show yesterday, Katie, you shared your personal story of how you've become more politically active, and one of those issues was transgenderism. Could you tell a little bit about why the transgender agenda is key to next-gen Marxism, and also a little bit about the sexual history of the next-gen Marxist thinkers, Frankfurt School et al., and Marx himself. These were, how shall we say this, perverts.
Yeah. I think, one of the things that I think's probably been most mystifying to all of us is how have we arrived at a point where parents are mutilating their children, removing healthy tissue and condemning children to a life of infertility and ongoing medical treatment. And how is it we have school board members signing in with their hands on a stack of books that include Lawn Boy and Genderqueer, right? It's just kind of mind-blowing. And so I think for me, you know, there were many elements of the book that were great to research because they were so eye-opening. You know, the piece on the role of Latin America, the turning point of 1989. But for me, I think one of the most important was also looking at the theme that has been there from the beginning of sexual deviancy and wanting to throw sexual morality. And it really starts with Rousseau. And it carries right on through Karl Marx. And I want to give here great credit to Paul Kangor, who just writes terrific books about who Karl Marx really was. And it continues right on through to people like Wilhelm Reich and then, of course, Michel Foucault. What you see is interesting. There is a theme, a very common theme among all the utopians, of which Marx is one, all the utopians are themselves hardcore sexual perverts or deviants, right? None of them can stay married to one person or stay faithful to one person and then go from there, right?
He just cheated on her.
Right, that's what I was going to say, right? And it just, you know, it really became apparent to me that their ideologies are in fact probably an outgrowth of their own sexuality. But it's really helpful to understand how central it is to them to destroy sexual morality, to destroy the family. And that's
They have to destroy the family because it's the pre-state, pre-political, most basic institution of civil society. We have here Jay Richards, who's a preeminent expert in all this. And they seek to, in the manifesto, Marx puts, abolish the family. They seek and they hold, this is something.
And BLM said it on their white webpage.
Until Andy Olivastro and I wrote a story about it for the New York Post. And then like good Marxists that they are, they airbrushed it out.
Yeah.
And it was 13 principles. No, it's only 12 now. Because that got a big readership in the New York Post in July 2020. So yeah, this Katie puts it very well. The family is the basic institution. Yeah. They have to destroy that to destroy society.
And Marx didn't even just want to destroy the family. He wanted to destroy marriage, and he actually just wanted a community of women, who would be available to men.
Yes.
That's in the manifesto.
Very egalitarian.
Community of women is in the manifesto.
Last question for you, Mike. We are at the Conservative Mothership, the Heritage Foundation. We are meant to inform policy on the principles upon which the Republic was founded. I'm going to ask you the impolitic question. How many people in that building just over there who actually make policy are fully aware that we are facing once more a global Marxist threat and the Marxists are inside America today?
So let me start with the good news. You should end with the good news.
There's three of them.
No. For example, Jim Banks, who's a member of the House from Indiana, he endorsed my book, he's in the book jacket. There are many, many good people who understand that we are under threat from an evolved type of Marxism, by the way. Something we haven't discussed here today is that it has evolved. It's not the economic Marxism that believes revolutions are absolutely necessary. You can have revolution if the opportunity comes up, or you can infiltrate and indoctrinate. This is a very important thing. And the many people who believe in this or who are gatekeepers of our cultural institutions would say, I'm not a Marxist. But as I was discussing in Seb's show yesterday, you have a lot of people who believe in raising taxes to throttle economic growth or increasing government spending, deficit spending, to increase economic growth, and they never heard the words John Maynard Keynes. And yet they're Keynesians. And there are many people walking around quoting Shakespeare, not knowing they're quoting Shakespeare. So over there, I find it frustrating sometimes that because a lot of this has to do ostensibly with race and sex, we all know that it has nothing to do with race or sex. It has everything to do with what David Horowitz used to say, the issue is never the issue, the issue is the revolution. But because it's sex, it's race, it's they don't want to touch it. They're very afraid. So on these cultural battles, I find some profiles in courage, and I sometimes often don't. So just leave it there.
The book, Next Gen Marxism, isn't just descriptive or historical. As with anything that is really important, you answer the question of so what? What is to be done, to quote a certain revolutionary? Katie, are you confident? Are we winning? Will we win? Give us some good news.
I'm encouraged. So when I came to the Heritage Foundation in the beginning of 2020, it was a few weeks before the COVID shutdown, which happened to coincide with really the beginning of the parents' rights movement. And so I quickly got pulled into that I was probably the lone traveler in 2020. I had airports to myself, but I continued traveling around the country, working with different parent groups who were trying to reclaim control over their children's education. I'm enormously encouraged by what I've seen in the country. I mean, I look at groups like Moms for Liberty, Moms for America. Those are the two big national ones, Parents Defending Education. Right. But there are, I'm telling you, there are thousands of groups around the country who are coming together to fight back against
this. And which didn't exist prior to 2020.
No, which didn't exist. And I think you see it everywhere over multiple different issues. And I think you're also seeing groups come together, you know, over a common issue. You know, some of the work fighting the transgender crisis has really brought left and right together. So I'm actually very encouraged.
It's not time to take a victory lap. There's a lot of work to be done, but I'm with Katie 100%. We have to be Reaganite about this. The American people, they overstepped their bounds in 2020. The revolutionaries, the gatekeepers of our cultural institutions were intimidated by this, enacted a raft of cultural changes that the American people just do not want to have.
Yeah.
And the American people need our help in making sure that they're able to reject this. So I am, by the way, I should say this, I tell you this all the time, I should say in front of C-SPAN, a great co-writer, a great co-author.
You can't do it again, I'm sorry. She's mine now. No. Thank you. All right, questions from the floor. We have a few minutes there. Gentleman in the camel hair coat.
Thank you. My name is PK Petrov. This was a great talk. I'd like to ask you whether or not you discuss in your book, when we talk about the transition from classical Marxism to cultural Marxism, or post-Marxism, you might call it, which really, the European developments are crucial, especially after the May 68 riots in France. And one of the most conspicuous differences between the old school of Marxists and the new ones is their radically different view on economic productivity and growth. Because in classical Marxism, there's this element.
We get it. The difference on economics. Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, my idea is that in the 70s and 80s, you have the growth of like environmentalism and the Green Party in Western Europe, which you now have this climate alarmism and this like very like anti-growth, degrowth attitude, which is quite different from the like
differences
Soviet
economically
moment.
Between the Marxist generations, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're absolutely right. And then this drives. By the way, the old-style Marxists who still believe in the Marxism you described, the new Marxists called them vulgar Marxists. That's a phrase that goes back to...
Called them what?
Vulgar.
Vulgar.
Vulgar Marxism. Goes back to 1926. Karl Korsch writes a book, and he says this is vulgar Marxism. They don't believe it. I haven't read Capital, cover to cover. I've skimmed Capital. I wouldn't imagine sitting down and reading Capital. But in it... Marx makes a bunch of, and not just in Capital, but also in the Manifesto, which I have read because it's much shorter. He says, well, the role of the proletariat is to destroy the owners of capital, the bourgeoisie. That's not true. The worker has zero interest in destroying the state, in abolishing the new world order that had hitherto existed. That's a verbatim phrase by Marx. Just like the worker in Michigan and Ohio just wanted better working conditions, but was patriotic, didn't want to overthrow.
Right.
And Marx believed, had all these beliefs that, for example, the social class you belong to was intrinsically related to your relationship to the means of production. Well, Gramsci comes along and says, culture is a means of production.
Mm.
You know, and so he liberates. They liberate not just Gramsci, but Karl Korsch, Max Horkheimer, Marcuse. And by the way, all these ideas do not just stay in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. They come here, they flourish, they really flower in the United States. And that's the reason why we have next-gen Marxists. So yes, you talked, I debated a Canadian Marxist for an hour and a half. And unfortunately, she used a word that we couldn't put it on the website. But she was saying, these are not Marxists. Gramsci's not a Marxist. She was really insulted by the fact that I was calling these cultural Marxists Marxists. They do share some key things. They boil the world down to an epic struggle between the oppressed and the oppressor. They do want to abolish the family. They do want to abolish the nation state. They have a lot of the bad traits that Marx had, but they're no longer economically determinist. Sorry.
Gentleman in the back.
My name is Cammy Bhatt. I'm with the Pakistani Spectator, and my question is, isn't the best way to combat Marxism is to take care of economic disparity? I'm from Pakistan, and it was very, very popular at one point. And I remember Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, he was socialist, and he literally destroyed Pakistani economy on the name of justice.
Okay.
Same thing
all
you
right,
can
you
do
got it.
America,
Mark,
like
okay.
the of New York and the economy of California. It's literally screwed.
All right, thank you. Is that the best way to approach
well,
it?
Well, I think it's relevant in a country like Pakistan or elsewhere where it is sort of the more traditional economic-based Marxism that's being implemented. But as Mike has explained, it's really a very different Marxism that's being implemented here. They're not in, I mean, yes, ultimately they want to pull down the free market economy, but there's yes. so much more that they want.
Yes.
The economic is not the foundation of the current Marxism.
In the front, yellow tie here, please.
We shouldn't assume either that they're motivated by economic injustice, that their hatred of economic injustice. It's a lot of envy that they're motivated by that we never talk about. Envy is a great motivator. They are motivated by a bunch of things, you know.
Well,
social...
if I may add, I mentioned this yesterday on the show, the great Rich Miniter was in discussions with Andrew Breitbart during the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations. And Breitbart were going to take a videographer team into the Occupy Wall Street protests. And Rich said to Andrew, have your guys ask the protesters one question. What is your relationship to your father? I think it's not just envy. What we are witnessing is self-hatred. And yes. from Obama to AOC, right. we are living in the most perverse of times, truly, where we are run by an elite that detests their own civilization. I mean, this is the perverse situation we are in. They hate the country they are running. I mean, who runs for president and says, I wish to fundamentally change this country? Well, then you don't love it.
I want to marry you, but I want to fundamentally change you.
No, if I told Katie, I love you, but I want to fundamentally change you, I wouldn't be on the couch, I'd be in the flipping doghouse, right? These people hate themselves and thus project externally. Question.
Hi, thank you. I'm going to buy three of these copies.
Is that all?
Just today, three.
Okay.
So,
Chris, come on.
More than three. So, can you guys talk a little bit about the deep state and its relationship with all of this? Because previously, State Department and other organizations, they were in the fight against
right.
Soviet communism, right. and now they seem to be the weapon of American next-gen Marxism. And so can you talk a little bit about that and connects to China and other things?
You mean you find it weird that the State Department yesterday announced that countries in Latin America shouldn't imprison the leaders of the opposition? You find that weird?
I do.
All right, as a former presidential appointee, deep state, Katie.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, Katie.
Yeah, they're absolutely bound up. I mean, we've seen, you know, we've seen from actually Obama's time when there was a tremendous effort to instill the ideas of DEI into the Department of Defense and other government departments and agencies. It's incredible. What I find really amazing, actually, and really alarming, and this is what Americans should be so upset about, is the degree to which the government now uses these government agencies to push these anti-American, not just un-American, anti-American policies across the country to instill them. They're holding our schools hostage. They're holding money hostage to the schools. They're pushing it in absolutely every aspect of the culture. And this is alarming. This is very alarming.
Well, and they're doing it openly. When you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs say, it's good that West Point teaches CRT. I don't know what it is, but it's good. We have a problem. All right, we have time for gentleman then and the lady there. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm a university student here at American University in DC, and I've witnessed this firsthand, how socialist and communist groups have usurped or, you know, attached themselves at the hip like parasites to this new, very pro-Palestinian Hamas movement. And not just in the US, but internationally. And it seems to be really shifting the focus in upcoming elections. For instance, in the UK, where you have the communist and pro-Chinese sympathizer Galloway, who just was elected to parliament on the back of this. Do you see this movement as another vehicle for which Marxists can further...
You mean the pro-Hamas movement?
Yes.
Is Galloway again in parliament?
Yes, he just won an election.
He was elected. He was
in a Muslim-majority district.
So actually, I would say the connection is right there, but I wouldn't say that they have attached themselves to this. They hate Israel because they hate us.
Yeah.
They see in Israel an extension of us. When they call Israel a white settler state, which is, they've never been to Israel, I suppose. it's because they call us a white settler state. So it's not that the Marxists have attacked, oh yeah, this is a pro-Palestinian thing that I want to attach myself to. No, they start off being anti-American and anti-West and anti-Judeo-Christian civilization, and that's the only reason they hate Israel. And that's why it's coming up all the time. They're saying, these pro-Palestinian demonstrators are saying, no, actually what we want is a dissolution of the United States and of the West entirely. It's like this. You want to add to that?
No, I was so shocked. I shouldn't be, but I was so shocked by that quote that you reposted of a pro-Palestinian demonstrator who was caught on tape saying, you know, this isn't really about Palestine. This is really about Hamas. This is really about taking down the United States.
But I'm seeing it now more and more.
Yeah.
The lady over there on the edge.
Hello, thank you, speakers. I'm half Chinese from Beijing and half Peruvian from Lima. And then I was born in the year of 1989. So my parents fleeing from Beijing to Peru. But then in 1992, I actually experienced the bombing. There was like the Shining Pass bombing. I was like one block away. Anyway, so my question is based on education system. Because my grandparents from my father's side is indigenous, they're indigenous, they spoke Quechua Aymara. So when I went back to Lima, Peru in Christmas 2021, and I went to the central bookstore in La Kumar, the very, very fancy place, I couldn't see any indigenous language, you know, because Quechua Aymara was the official language. So through the last 3 years of COVID, you know, American children, they're actually delayed on their IQ and EQ. We're really behind of China, you know, like, so
how— So what's the question, please?
Yeah, education system. So how do we catch up? How do we correct that? Because our children are delayed, you know, mentally, emotionally.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is it
fixable? Is the education system salvageable?
I mean, I think everything's— Right. I think everything's fixable. Do I think the education system is salvageable is a different question. I mean, I love Kevin Roberts' response when you once asked him, what do we do about the universities? And he said, burn them down.
That's a quote.
I think it should be alarming for everybody that I think it's 85 or 90% of our children are still educated in public schools. And when you look at the insidious influence of the teachers' unions and the position that they have taken, they have fully bought into this and they are fully pushing it. I don't know how anybody sends their kids to public school, but I think to the degree to which parents continue to step up and take control of education, I think we're on a good path. But I will say, I think in all of this, my biggest concern remains the universities.
Yeah.
They just, you know, it is just too difficult, you know, for all of us. You know, if you can get your kid into Yale, if you can get your kid into Harvard, you know, yes, you want that, you know, and you just, like, we're ignoring what those universities are doing to our kids.
Yeah.
And until we really put our foot down with the universities, I think we're in trouble.
I think we need to fight for the good schools. We need to fight for the Ivies. We have to reform them. I don't think we can burn them because they're too important to, and by the way, no, they're not gonna take them away from us. We have to fight back for them. But anyway, I agree with 99% of what you said.
Using my chairman's prerogative, I want to say you can't change them unless you fire everybody.
Well, I'm not against that.
Okay. All right, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Please follow Katie and Mike. For some reason, he goes by Gundy Salvis on Twitter. Katie is...
My name in Latin. You always bring this up.
I know. Nobody is that educated nowadays. It went to Harvard. Come on. And Katie at Gorka Katie. The book is available outside. The authors will stay around to answer your personal questions and to dedicate books. Thank you to Dr. Roberts, and thank you to the Heritage Foundation. Thank you for coming in person. God bless.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.